Welcome to another production of the Center for Emerging Media, and I'm Mark Steiner. The other day, an old friend and colleague and poet, Andre Kondrescu, stopped by for a visit, and we talked about a lot of things that day. You might recognize his voice from all of his commentaries on NPR. We might have read one of his many stories, poems, or essays that he's written over the years. But we sat down for what was a really casual conversation, and I asked him about some of his most recent work, including It Was Today, New Poems, and his new novel, Wakefield, where he wrestles with the devil, and a collection of writing about his adopted and new love city, New Orleans, Mon Amour. When I was reading, I didn't finish this yet, but I really was getting it. I got into it. I read this at night. I just got these a couple days ago. So one of the things that hit me as I was reading all these three books is that this is weird to say. I don't know how to put this. It's almost as if you're like a mystical materialist in the way you look at the world.
Well, that's really great. I mean, can I quote that on the back of a book?
You can use it.
I remember when Choyam Trungpai, you know, was warning his followers about something he called spiritual materialism, which became quite manifest in the spiritual communities because everybody felt sort of holier than thou, and so he warned them against being, you know, spiritual, you know, wealth, you know, gatherers, or, you know, having egos too big for their practice, you know, which was humility, you know. So, but I think you mean it probably some other way. But I mean, you know, the New Orleans stories, where these episodic stories about living in New Orleans for a very long time, and New Orleans is a very strange city. I mean, it's old, and it has that comforting feeling of history where you sit down in a restaurant and you know that somebody sat in the same place and died. So, you know, feels mm-hmm. good. It's been, mm-hmm. it's there. And so, and, you know, it has a spirituality. It's a diverse, you know, the Catholics are really, a lot of them voodoo practitioners, or at least voodooistic in some way. After one of the big storms, I think it was Ivan, who didn't quite hit New Orleans, but everybody was expecting to, and they had an evacuation that was relatively successful. But I met a priest on the street with a little girl and the girl's father, and they'd just been to one of the convents to turn the statue of the Virgin toward the storm, because it apparently had worked in the past whenever the city was under attack by a storm or a war or a yellow fever. Mm-hmm. There is this thing they do, which is they turn the Virgin. Well, it worked pretty good until Katrina, of course, but maybe they didn't get to it on time. But you know, things of that nature, you know. And then I read a book called a novel written in 1848 by a German writer, Baron von Riesenstein.
Who, you write a lot about him in this race.
Yeah, oh, it's an amazing guy. He, 1848, his father sent him to New Orleans to get away from the revolutionary troubles in Germany.
Right.
So he comes to New Orleans and founded a German language newspaper. There were two of them at the time. This was Louisiana Stadtzeitung, which was the bohemian paper. It was artistic and hip. And he started writing a serial called The Mysteries of New Orleans, and it was very accurate insofar as the city and the streets and the current scandals went, because his readers checked him. They read it every day. But then he just took off and made this magic. You know, there's a thousand-year-old guy. The seeds of the yellow fever come from the Red River. And, you know, there are these two sisters. And he describes, well, they're not really sisters, but they're lovers. And he describes lesbian sex for the first time in American literature, in German.
In the 19th century.
Oh, yeah. 18.
That's amazing.
We're talking before the Civil War,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, and there are all kinds of, there's a sadistic priest who kills children. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's just filled with, you know, extraordinary drama and magic. And so I wrote a novel called Messiah in 1999, and I was, you know, I was picking up also sorts of fantastic stuff. And then I read The Mysteries of New Orleans about a year after, and I thought, man, you know, I mean, it was the same city, same place, same feeling, you know. So the city does have materially something, you know, spiritual screwed
something's
in it.
Something's going on. Because you also write about, coming back to the Russian scene in a minute, but you made me think of the pieces you wrote about synchronicity in this kind of strange world that we live in, and how these things connect. What's that story you told about this young girl? It was a quote you had, and then you met this young girl in a bar, and then she had the quote, and her lesbian lover came and snatched it away, and they went back to your place.
Well, that was one of the weirder true things about the entire writing of Messiah, because I was stuck in the book, and I typed a sentence from the Nag Hammadi, the Gnostic Gospel, so I just opened the book, and it said, our sister Sophia, she who is a whore.
Right.
And so I closed the book, I typed it in for no good reason. I went to the bar around the corner, Molly's. I was sitting at the window, and then this little girly twig put a couple of leaf hands over my eyes and said, guess the name of my new band. And I said, oh, I didn't even know who it was. I said, oh, no, not a young people's band. And I said, okay, I didn't know who it was. I said, well, what is it? And she said, our sister Sophia, she who is a whore, literally. And I just sort of, everything stood and turned around. And it was this girl that I'd seen her before, but I didn't know her, Michelle. And so I said, where did you get that? Oh, she says, it's a Gnostic gospel. So she said, I've been reading them since I was 13 years old. At which point this, you know, rather, you know, hefty, not hefty, but, you know, vigorous and muscular person came and just grabbed her off the stool. And
it's a woman,
to take off the door with her. So I just kind of followed them and, you know, I said, what's the story? And this was Nurse Susan, who'd been following Michelle around for a while because Michelle was out of control. And so I took them both back to my apartment, where Michelle proceeded to sort of recite whole parts of my character, which I was writing. And so I threw out everything I was writing, and I sort of transcribed her hallucinations. Well, I knew her after several times we met, and she didn't recall any of this. And she, every time I brought it up, she just put a finger to her lips and said, shh.
When you contemplate that, what do you make of that? What do you think goes on that you stumble into these things, these become part of your life? What do you think this is?
Well, with that one, I had about three scenarios. One that somehow the page printed itself and it blew down the street and Michelle found it. Totally impossible. Well, somebody kind of stole my computer and traveled in time. I don't know. You know, it doesn't make any sense. It never did, you know. I never to this day figured it out. But, you know, people in New Orleans, you tell them stuff like that, they always say, oh, yeah, look, I've got to tell you about this thing. You know, that's usually something equally, unprovable and unbelievable, you know. So the city does have that kind of... This little black holes, this wormholes that you travel. And then the business about synchronicity is that, you know, so much happens that is not explicable in that way, that I figure that part of my job is to fight it. You know, not let it happen, man, because maybe everything is connected perfectly. And if you really knew it, then you just have no choice but, you know, to take heavy doses of Demerol or something.
And I couldn't do any work if I did that.
Well, whatever that stuff is that stops you from figuring it out. You know?
I mean, it's been a while since I've read your stuff. So when this came the other day, I was really got into it, started reading it as much as I could consume before I knew we were going to get together. And I mean, when I said earlier about you being kind of a mystical materialist, it's a word I've used for years for other things, but there's something about the definition of this world. You know, the people are either mystical and spiritual and don't believe in a material base, or they're, like my old communist friends, all materialistically based, and the mystical is over here, they don't believe in it. But somehow to me, what your work does, it's been helping me think it through, is the connection of the two, how they actually meet and really a part of one, as opposed to being separate worlds.
Well, that's very that's a very kind way to say it. You know, I mean, I never, you know, I mean, I was born in a very small town in Romania, a very provincial place, and you know, I mean, from Sibiu to New Orleans is a kind of an underground personal route, you know. So things that happen to me, whether they happen, you know, I mean, like they happen to everyone, I was endowed them with a little more significance because they seemed like a big deal, especially when I was younger. I wrote an autobiography when I was 23 years old. You know, not that much had happened to me, you know, but the few things that happened seemed really important, you know. I mean, I wasn't nervy enough to actually write it in the first person, you know. I didn't say I said he, like I was the hero of my own story,
and out of body.
This thing has happened to me, you know, to this character. But in doing that and then writing a book, I created a kind of initiatory structure that had to be there. I mean, the, you know, your hero, that he encounters various terrible things and dangers and reads certain things and does certain things and then wins something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this case, you know, just getting out of Romania and, you know, having the chance to start another life in another language, really being literally born again. So paying attention to kind of everything that happened, you know, it became sort of significant. So when I write it, it's because I think probably it's, you know, it means something. You know, so I've always had a feeling that things mean something, that they're not just chance. Although, you know, I mean, I would be very hard put to defend that, you know, because I'm not a mystic or a believer particularly. And I just did a long interview with a Romanian theologian, a guy from a town called Arad, Robert Lazu, and it was great doing it because he's not...
You were interviewing him?
No, he interviewed me from via email.
Uh-huh.
And he was asking questions a writer or a literary person wouldn't ask, you know. They had to do with various ideas, and most of the interview I did from Andrew Cohen's place in the Berkshires. I don't know if you know his community.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they publish a magazine called What is Enlightenment?
Oh, yes. I have deep connections to the Berkshires. I'm there a lot. Right.
Andrew invited me to have a series of talks there with him, and they gave me a beautiful little apartment in this manicured quad in the fresh air. I mean, I was having... And with Wi-Fi, so
with Wi-Fi,
yeah. So these are, you know, really plugged in spiritual people. So, you know, I was talking to Andrew and with some of his people and talking about things like creativity and, you know, how certain things work in ways that are not explicable with a materialist philosophy or take. And I was answering questions at the same time from this Romanian guy who was trained in the school of Mircea Eliade and Jung, and really a sort of a archetypal psychology and folklore.
Is
and,
he Orthodox? What was he?
No, actually, he's Catholic, which is really strange because he's Roman Catholic in Romania, which is mostly a Greek Orthodox country. But he's a theologian, so he had, you know, but he studied Eliade, and he was a folklorist, too, and he collected folk tales and myth, and so it all fit in very nicely, and it was a good time to examine that question, you know, of what is inexplicable. Andrew and all his people believe in evolutionary consciousness is what they call it, and their philosophy is fairly basic in a way. I mean, to say that people are the result of 2 billion years of evolution, and there is a reason for that, and that we're still evolving, and these are the ways in which you're doing that, and so his job and his people's job is to open a dialogue on that subject, you know, so... I mean, I'm very skeptical, so I did play the devil's advocate the whole time.
Right.
And I said, you know, yeah, but, you know. So
you see, but you do that, but I bet you have to also be affected by it. You can't have these conversations and not in some level be affected by it?
Well, there was a very beautiful woman who was working on spirituality and feminism there, and we had long discussions, you know, so I was very attracted to her. So there was a definite material base to the entire, to my spiritual interests, you know, which reminds me that in the 60s, you know, I was often very holy in order to get laid.
Well, who didn't, right? Yeah.
My hair wasn't really long.
You didn't have long, you did have long
hair. I did, but it was symbolic.
So what, you got here, what year to America?
Well, 1966, March 1966, to Detroit, Michigan, on a very cold day.
And, Detroit, that's right, Detroit, right.
Yeah, it was, I was in Rome, and it was hot and warm and actually beautiful, and things were in flower, and I got to Detroit, and there was nothing but sleet and mud and cars. Till I met John Sinclair and
John Sinclair,
the Artist Workshop.
Yes, right.
Then my hair sprouted, and you know.
I've been talking to him over the years.
Yeah, he's between Amsterdam and New Orleans, right. Quite a bit.
Which, and New Orleans.
Yeah, he was a DJ for WWOZ and just played fantastic music. Right.
John's a good guy. He's a really interesting guy.
He's wonderful.
He was here last summer, summer before last as well. We hooked up. I hadn't seen him in a long time.
Somebody actually told me, it was Barry Gifford. He said he hadn't seen John in about 15 years, and he was walking in New York, and John was sitting on a stoop in the Bowery. And he looked up, and Barry said, "John." And John said, "What took you so long?"
He was a good man. Yeah, he still is a good man. So looking at this last night again before. I mean, I had to read a whole lot last night of the stuff to make sure I had some of the new stuff you were writing, and it forced me to consume more wine than I wanted to at night to stay awake. But it worked.
Welcome to the company. I was going to bring you some Tuica, this Romanian plum brandy, but in Romania it would be okay to do it now. But
we can do it now. It's okay. So, have you been aware or written about the Baltimore-New Orleans connection? I mean, the fact that Cajuns came here first before they came to Louisiana, that
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So they were here and they weren't welcome?
The British kicked them out of Nova Scotia.
Right.
The ships came up the Chesapeake, dropped them off here. Downtown Baltimore, on Baltimore between Pratt and Lombard, it's called Frenchtown because that's where a lot of them lived.
Uh-huh.
Baltimore accepted them. Some of the counties hated them because there was all this anti-Catholic stuff going on, anti-French stuff. And so they were here for like 10 years. And then they went from here to New Orleans. And the other connection is that Baltimore, I thought about this because you came here and then left here and went to New Orleans. And Baltimore is also, and New Orleans are both the centers of Black Catholicism.
Right.
You know?
I knew that. I just wasn't aware that the Cajuns had actually...
Yeah, they were here.
They made the stop here.
1750s, and then they left and went to Louisiana.
Right. Well, there is a whole revival of that culture now because, among other things, the French government has been, through Francophone Studies departments, putting some money into reviving the language and publishing some newspapers, and suddenly the Cajun kids who didn't speak any French or picking up the language again. And of course, the music is kept going, and the jokes and the fairy tales and all of that.
So now you really have adopted Louisiana and New Orleans. I mean, it really is. Like Romania might have been your home as a child. This is really your home.
Well, it is now. I mean, it's been 25 years, but it's not. I mean, it's the southern Louisiana, which is very different than northern Louisiana, which is more like Mississippi and Baptist. I really do love New Orleans. I mean, this thing that's happened there has changed the city.
Katrina.
Considerably, but it's still the New Orleans. There's something there, a spirit of place, you know, this kind of, they called, you know, the Romans had this idea of spirits of place, you know, and they're definitely there. So I live in the French Quarter.
Is that where you live now?
Yeah, and well, I have an apartment there, so.
You're still teaching though in Baton Rouge?
In Baton Rouge, and you know, it's I live in the quarter and I don't drive, so I feel like I need a passport to go across Canal Street. But yeah, it's a home. But then I also, you know, feel that it's become a kind of scary, rude, naked kind of bare knuckle city right now. It's not, and I'm not talking about just it being dangerous on the street because it always was, but just that there are so many pigs at the trough in the political scene, and all the well-meaning people who make plans for the city, for rebuilding and reconstruction, are actually being screwed by real estate developers. And the best people in town are young volunteers, a lot of kids who've given up their school breaks to come to New Orleans and to rebuild. And
right.
Habitat for Humanity, and even the churches have been doing a great job. Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing did all right. And then they meet the entrenched bureaucracies at all levels, the city, the states, and the feds. And right now it's just a bunch of money with lots of hands grabbing it, and the casinos getting the people's money, and politicians also getting the people's money and doing with it God knows what.
Do you think New Orleans is done? Do you think that, done in the sense that the spirit of that place that people are in love with, even with the danger inside of it, is over?
No, I don't think it's over. I think it's going to be a small city. You know, it already is half the size of what it was. Population-wise, it will be small. The people who really made it interesting were the poor people, because they are the ones who kept the culture. I mean,
right.
That music comes from poverty. It comes
right.
from, you know, poverty is art. Because, you know, it's one of a kind. If you can buy it at the store, you make it yourself. And that's what this music and this art was all about. And some of the young artists are coming in. I really mean to do that, but the rents have gone. There's less housing. Rents are through the roof. The real estate, you know, the crisis that's hit the whole country didn't go mm-hmm. anywhere near New Orleans because places are more expensive there. And so it will be, the battle is between a Disneyfied version of New Orleans, which will provide, however, jobs for musicians who never could make it in New Orleans. They always had to leave because there aren't enough places for them to play. But if we got Disney, they'll have enough places to play. It was the paradox. Kind of unexpected that you got, as soon as you got out of the French Quarter or uptown and you went someplace, and you know, like my friend Jim who came to visit and ended up staying for 3 weeks with some people he didn't know, that New Orleans, you know, is unfortunately you know, severely diminished.
And the poor people aren't back. I mean, most of them are not back. They're still scattered, right?
Well, no, I mean, yeah, they're scattered. They're gone. I mean, both in from St. Bernard Parish and certainly the Ninth Ward, you know. And, you know, and I can say, you know, for them, if you look at it from their point of view, you can't, you know, buy the kind of racial discourse either, you know, that they're black and poor and they should come back to New Orleans, because if they are somewhere where they can put their kids in better schools, and they don't have any reason to come back to New Orleans and spend 20 years hustling with bureaucracies so they could rebuild
right.
a house 5 feet off the ground. You know, I mean, there is definitely a kind of human, you know, just a simple human thing involved that goes beyond, you know, New Orleans rara. I mean, I know the New Orleans Tourism Bureau always wants you to put on the good face, you know, and say, well, great things are happening
right.
because, you know, we're rebuilding. But, you know, then you talk to the people and say it's a shithole, and it's always been a shithole.
But there was soul in the shithole, and the question is the soul going to be still going to be able to control the culture and the kind of what pushes the city, what pushed the feeling in that city, you know?
Well, that's, you know, that's what I have to become more mystical than materialist, because I kind of believe, you know, that that's going to happen, but I don't have any facts, you know? So, the facts are pointing the other way. You know? So.
But, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, one of the things you wrote, the thing I was reading last night and this morning was, there it is, My City, My Wilderness, that you wrote in 95.
You're right.
To me, when I read this, I was reading this, maybe I'm wrong about this, Andre, but it seemed, on some levels, this is like almost like the core of the book in a way.
Right. That's definitely the core of the book. And that's the part that actually doesn't take prisoners, because there is a lot of the bad stuff about the city in there, too. I mean,
right.
There's poetry, but then there is the fact that it's a gruesomely brutal city that's, you know, was the worst slave market in America, and it was the, you know, northern end of the slave and rum and, route that started in Martinique in the south, you know, so, you know. So slave rum and sugar, really.
Right.
Cuba, you know, Martinique, Cuba, Jamaica, Haiti. So, you know, that's always been there, and that's why you have those really good blues, and you do have that really good deep music. It's not just the Mississippi Delta, but it's New Orleans is where that got perfected and made into the American sound.
You know, it's interesting because without... I was thinking of this, the friend of mine here that we came back from a jazz concert, and Woody Curry, who's African American, Vietnam vet, a really good guy, and he, I said, you know, without the pain of slavery, the horror of slavery, we'd never have the American culture. We'd never have jazz and blues. We'd never have the writers we ended up with. We'd never have a lot of things if there wasn't that part of our history. It's that weird.
Well, that's what, you know, Baudelaire called that Le Fleur du Mal, you know, that you have these flowers that come out of this swamp, you know, out of pain, you know. All of a sudden you have this blossoms, you know. I mean, I've had students who've come from really tough situations, and they're just incredible writers. Olympia Vernon, who's a novelist, very, you know, talked about now, and she comes from a trailer from the depths of Black Louisiana, and she's just extraordinary. Now, there is no... you know, that soil, that nourished her, all that pain and all that stuff, and that's recent. I mean, you put that back a few decades in the century, and you get, you know, the ways in which people try to escape it, and that was music, and that was, you know, style, it was culture, you know, the city...
Right.
The city was hospitable to it in the sense that the French already had made a laissez-faire atmosphere there, in which they had black or Creole mistresses that had, who had children who were educated in special schools for the illegitimate children of the French aristocrats, up to a point, because then some of them recognized them and took them into the families.
And some of them owned slaves too.
And
Creoles.
Some of them owned slaves. You see all this history in the cemeteries. It's all written on the tombstones, really. But so you have that. So the idea that there's anybody in New Orleans, there's nobody white in New Orleans, for one thing, because it's just not possible. So, you know, it's a city of color, you know, of various kinds. And so what you can maintain in some insane way is color lines. But, you know, you can't say that... There is a race, you know, kind of a clear race war going on, or battle of any kind. So the music and the art and all of that stuff was common property. Sure, the French had an opera house that burned down, and the museum in New Orleans caters to the uptown mavens who like to go there and, you know, do their balls, and the carnival crews are still segregated to some extent. You have the white Rex parade, and you have the parody Zulu, which is actually bigger and is not a parody anymore. So, you know, I mean, these cultures have played off of each other in interplayed. So to anything that's maintained in the sense of an old establishment of white or a white establishment is really kind of an illusion, like Mardi Gras. You know, you put on the mask and then things change.
So, Andre, we'd be remiss if we didn't get you to read some stuff.
Sure.
And I don't. Do you have anything? I mean,
I don't know. I want you to just ask me some questions, and I'll open the books and answer them with whatever my eyes fall. It's called oracular reading. And
okay.
Right. Then
let's start with Wakefield. Then
I do this all the time now. Wakefield is the story of a guy, me, but it's not supposed to be me in my apartment.
Are you he or are you the devil?
No,
I'm just kidding.
Girls always have to. But he comes to take the guy, and the guy says, well, just give me a year so I can read, you know. So the devil makes a deal, and he loses, you know. So that's the story of Wakefield, is a novel.
It's a great story. I must tell you, I've only gotten a quarter way through. I just got the books the other day, so I've been reading it. Just, yeah. I love it. I love this. I love the beginning of the book where the devil just comes and he asks for a scotch and they sit to discuss.
Well, the first scene is in my apartment in New Orleans, because I describe everything.
So you want to open a piece of that book and just read and see where you end up with?
Okay. Is there anything special you want to know about the devil, New Orleans, or me?
I suppose. What is it that, again, it's this mystical materialism for me, again, of you, because of you and the devil just popping up together.
The voices of God are everywhere heard loud and clear under the hum of the ticker tape, and all these miracles and speaking gods and the mysteries left homeless by the architecture of speed and moving forward onward in the head. Wakefield throws his hands into the air as if to sprinkle fairy dust on the room. He is evoking the richness of a place always ready for miracles. It's a pretty good book, huh? My idea is that if you ask a book a question and it answers it, then it's a good book. And if it doesn't, then you throw it away.
Which is why you keep the Gnostic Gospels and just open it
right
to any place.
Right. It's a surrealist. It's an old surrealist trick. Everything connects at some level. Yeah.
It is. Well, I mean, I suppose growing up in Romania, in this kind of strange country as a little Jewish boy, you have to be surreal.
You have to
live in it.
You have to first wonder how you survived, because how my mother and her generation survived, because the entire, my grandmother's sisters were killed at Auschwitz, and the entire Hungarian Jews, all the Hungarian Jews died. So that side of my family is gone, killed by the Nazis and Romanians. And then the other part that escaped made it, you know. So
how did your parents survive?
Well, the way my mother tells it is that she and her sister and her sister's husband and my grandmother escaped over the mountains the night that the Germans took over Hungary. And so they escaped deportation because they were in Romania. And Romanians were pretty anti-Semitic as well, but they were very ineffective compared to the Hungarians, thank God. That's why I have a fondness for a little bit of corruption.
It's good to be with people who are not effective anti-Semites, the ones who are effective, right?
Right. So they were able to sort of bribe their way to survival until the end of the war. So, you know, God bless the, you know, slightly corrupt authorities of Romania. You know, so that's how, you know. So then I was born right after the war.
Right. 46. Same year I thought we were. Okay, so let's go somewhere else. Let's go to, I'll shut this book let's see.
Okay, we can do the poems if you like.
We can do some poems. Just
in the same fashion?
The same fashion, sure. I guess the question is the power of New Orleans and what keeps you so rooted there?
I saw some writing in a stream. I couldn't read what it said. It said, Luli, 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 there is a gray hair among your black ones. It said that. I couldn't read it. Now, I have to explain that. Cause
please.
This middle of the poetry book is a sort of a channeled section written by two lovers from China in the 13th century, Luli and Wengli, who were maybe brother and sister, maybe lovers, or maybe both. And Wang went to war, and Luli stayed behind as a curtain. And they wrote each other poetry, letters, which they may or may not have seen. So I got up every morning one year, I think, was in the late 90s, and I wrote Luli and Wangli poems. And I was convinced that I was writing these Chinese poets. I even had them translated into Chinese.
Did you really?
Chinese scholars said, well, they seem a little modern. I said, well... had to travel a while, you know, on the waves there. You know. So this is Lou Leeds speaking, the one who I just
read. Where did you find them? How did you stumble onto them?
Well, I was, you know, I was very much in love with my now wife, Laura, and I would write her a poem before she got out.
Your second wife, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then I would write her a poem, and then I was impatient. I wanted her to write a response. But since she didn't get up on time, I wrote her response too. So I ended up writing most of the book. Some of them are hers, actually.
Are you and Laura still together?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That's good. Just checking. Well, I didn't know.
Since the 13th century.
That's right. That's good, since the 13th century.
Yeah.
So let's go here. I mean, so I have an off-the-wall thought since the 13th right. century. So are there Jewish vampires?
I think they're actually, I don't have to look at the book to tell you that they're one and the same thing. Because the vampire figure in Romania was created was the quintessential figure of the other. So they were vampires were based on Jews.
Vampires were based on Jews?
Yeah, the vampire was another who comes in at night and sucks your blood. And you remember the blood libel, which was used very widely in Russia, and that's an anti-Semitic slur that Jews made matzo with the blood of Christian children.
Right.
So all that got incorporated into this figure that was quintessentially other. He wasn't one of us. He came in at night. And when you look at pictures, the first depictions of vampires, they're made like Jews, and then Jews are made to look like the devil. So the devil, the vampire, and the Jew are exactly the same thing for the lovely, kind-hearted people of the Eastern Europe. So, well, let's see
what... The sweet people of Eastern Europe.
Right, so here is another answer. Death was the theme this year. Now, the carnivals, you know, the crews pick themes every year, so the crew de Vieux Carré is my favorite because they make fun of everything, and their theme this particular year was death. The crew de Vieux Carré chose death as its theme this year. We paraded funereally through the French Quarter, black chiffon angels, executioners, coffins, wreaths, and a guillotine. That isn't all that unusual in this town where death enjoys respect and familiarity, where people bury each other to the tune of jazz bands and live as if there were no tomorrow, which could pretty well be the case if the levees break. This was written before Katrina, needless to say.
But now, death plays a big part of what you write about in New Orleans, whether you're writing about, somebody should do a story about that you said about how many restaurants are near cemeteries and how that, where you said, as you sat down, one of the first things you said here was, you know, when you're in New Orleans and you sit in a seat, you know, when someone who either long ago or now recently has died, who just sat in the seat, that the notion of death is...
Well, that's always present in New Orleans, and I think it's been there for a very long time, because the carnival itself is a blowout before Ash Wednesday. And the word carnival comes from carnevale, which means farewell to the flesh. So you get to party, and then you get to repent. And so you put the ashes on your forehead, and you, you know, supposedly have died symbolically and gone somewhere else. But, you know, people are so Catholic and so dedicated to carnival that they do both by staying up all night on Mardi Gras and then putting the cross of ashes on their forehead from the ashtray in front of them instead of going to the church to do so that's all there, you know. So, that makes it a very strong, it's a strong presence. I mean, the cemeteries are very important. People do the Day of the Dead business by going to clean the tombs of their ancestors. I used the cemetery near my house as a coffee house for a long time because I would go... have my coffee. It was very quiet in the morning. And actually, I took a Polish artist, a visiting Polish artist, to have coffee in the Lafayette Cemetery in uptown. And we were having our coffee, and then he told me how during communism, he was a high school teacher, he was a history teacher, and he took his students to the main cemetery in Warsaw, and he taught them history by pointing to the graves of various important historical personages and telling, really teaching them the true history, not the one in the manuals that you're supposed to teach.
So one of the stories in here is, I haven't remembered right, is a fellow Romanian who made alligator piquant.
Oh, yeah. This guy was a trip. I just got a call, and this guy said, well, come, I'm Romanian, and I own a little place here called the Golden Crawfish in Baton Rouge. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. So I went to see him, and he told me that this was during communism, actually. He met a Swede on a train who drew a picture of a crawfish for him and said, do you have these in Romania? And he said, yeah, sure. And he said, well, the Swedes love to eat them. And so he organized collectives of children to pick crawfish and ship them to Sweden until he figured out how the Swedes like to eat them. So then he cooked them and made the sauce and started shipping them prepared. And he got, you know, a good source of revenue for the government and himself. But they ran out of crawfish. They fished out the country. So then he started flying all over the place for crawfish. And eventually, I'm not sure how, he stopped in Louisiana and didn't go back to Romania and opened the crawfish restaurant. And while he was talking, he's pointing up in the air and saying, "See, there are planes full of my crawfish overhead right now." So he said, "If you ever need money for anything like a movie or something, I'll get it to you." His wife looking horrified, you know, just. So he's crazy. So he turned out to be an interesting guy. His daughter worked there. It was a family restaurant. It's not open anymore, but that's how Romanians got to Louisiana.
I love that.
Not like Cajuns, but
different trajectory.
But so. Anyway, I'm working on a book called Lenin and Tsara Play Chess, and it takes place in 1915 when both Lenin and Tristan Tzara, the founder of the Dada movement, and Cabaret Voltaire and modern art, they were both in Zurich in 1915. Zurich, Switzerland was neutral. Lenin was on exile, living under a pseudonym. There were other Russian revolutionaries there, like Radek and Zinoviev. Right. They were all living there. Tsara was living there. Hans Arp, Marcel Janko, Dadaists, artists, Romanians. They all hung out at a cafe called La Terrasse. There is
all of them, even Lenin really did?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Lenin and Cabaret Voltaire and Tsara lived on the same street. Spiegelgasse. Uh-huh. And James Joyce was there at the same time.
Really?
Yeah, the whole, all of them. And I found out that Lenin and Tsara played chess quite a bit. Lenin was a big, big chess aficionado. There's a famous game he played with Maxim Gorky that you can find online.
And, oh, yeah.
You can play it. I did.
You played it?
Yeah, it's interesting.
You?
Yeah. And but Tsara and Lenin played chess, and that game seemed very symbolic to me, and there's a play by Tom Stoppard called Travesties, which actually has them all together, Lenin, Tsara, and Joyce. But I'm just concerned with Tsara and Lenin, because it's just before the Russian Revolution. It's 1915. Tsara just founded this violent art movement, this avant-garde movement that overthrows everything we know about art. They think all Western civilization art is shit, and they are going to destroy it by all means possible. And they are creating simultaneous poetry. They are making mask theater with masks and having a hell of a time and disturbing the peace of the good citizens of Zurich. Lenin is much quieter, and he's there planning the Russian Revolution. So there are two. The chess game is symbolic. It's sort of the anatomy of a scene. Like they do this thing on TV where the director talks about it and the makeup guy and the actor. And, you know, so they play this game of chess. And it's a game between art and ideology. It's really a game between a new kind of art, making new forms, being spontaneous, working outside the rules. And there is Lenin, who's systematic, who's methodical, who's developing a tactic for the revolution, and writing essays about it, Marx and Hegel, and they're playing this chess game. Now, the game itself has rules and is completely insane, and is played for some reason by all kinds of people who love power. There's a dictator right now who's built a whole chess city somewhere in one of the former Soviet republics, and then you have Bobby Fischer. You have a lot of nuts who get into chess in a very obsessive ways. I mean, Marcel Duchamp ended up, you know, playing chess instead of making art in New York for years. So Tsara and Lenin play chess, and it looks for a while historically that Lenin's ideological game won. Because in 1917, the revolution wins in Russia, and it lasts for almost a century. And Dadaism, however, changes entirely our idea of art, and is incredibly effective in getting us out of the 19th century and making new forms for art. But sort of overshadowed really by ideology and by ideas of different kinds of ideas of social engineering. So in 1989, official state communism collapses and Leninism is dead. And guess what? Dadaism is still going strong. It's a neo-Dada. And all of the Dadaists sense that what we're making creatively and spontaneously is the actual revolution of the spirit, and you got to keep it alive in this any way you can, and not regimentalize it is alive and kicking. So Lenin lost the game, Tara won the game, in my opinion. So this is an essay I'm writing.
It's an essay or a book?
It's a book essay. It's a long essay.
Right.
Yeah, Princeton is going to publish it, so hopefully we'll get some photographs and all that. It's never clear that Lenin and Tara actually played the game, but Tara said they did in an interview in 1959 on the radio, and then Hans Arp, I think, mentions the fact that they played chess at La Terrasse, which was this place. So I found that to be a really crucial moment, 1915 in neutral Switzerland.
I love that. So did you go to Zurich?
I'm going there, June.
Just to kind of walk the streets and kind of be there, or what?
Yeah, I mean, the Swiss have made little, you know, shrines around where Cabaret Voltaire used to be, and there's little signs, but it's still, I mean, it's all very understated because the Swiss don't like to make a big thing out of it. And at the time, of course, the neighbors called the police all the time, and the Dadaists were making a lot of noise, playing drums and screaming, and they didn't bother about Lenin, who, you know, was a quiet Russian. You know? he didn't bother anybody. He was living there actually under a pseudonym. What was it? Jacob Richter. He'd taken a German Jewish name, which is really interesting too. And he used the same pseudonym in London when he was doing his studies at the British Library.
Right, I remember that. That's right. Right.
Jacob Richter, and he was well quarter Jewish, as it turns out.
Lenin was.
Yes.
And we're just insidious. We're everywhere, aren't we?
We got a gene, man. It's the Messiah gene. I don't know what the hell it is.
So, maybe they're right. That's why they come after us all
Vampires,
the time.
Vampires, devils, and devils. Utopians.
And now we've mingled with black people in America. It's just a terrible
thing.
Thank
goodness. So. Miscegenation. That's my religion.
Yes, I too.
Creolize.
So, I have a couple more questions, and we'll let you go. Do kind of you have things to do today, and you've got things to do. So, sure. Off the wall questions.
All right.
So, will miscegenation rule?
Ultra-realist depictions of time and place, complete with nose hairs, cataracts, swollen feet, warts, intestinal distress, political opinions, and social codes. Yes.
And so, will the spiritual form of the Dadaists actually take hold? Or can it never take hold because of what it is?
Lying on my back, the emperor's astrologer on top of me, I thought of the stars. Years ago they foretold this. They could not tell that their astrologer's labors were in vain. Even the stars have no say in who works for them.
Perfect.
Good books.
Good books. That's great. Yeah. All right. Andre, thank you so much, man.
It's a great pleasure, always.
It's really good to see you. You've been listening to a production for the Center for Emerging Media. This podcast was produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy, and we'd like to thank Carr Kizier and the Creative Writing Forum at the Community College of Baltimore County in Essex for bringing Andre Kondrescu to Baltimore. And thanks to Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design for studio space. And from the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.